You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Genesis, Secrets of Creation. This is lecture 2, given on the 18th of August, 1910, entitled Ha'aretz and Hashamayim. In a good many places in the course of these lectures, as well as elsewhere in our anthroposophical discussions, it may well appear, particularly to the outside world, who are hardly aware of the kind of feelings that prevail in our circles, as if I rather enjoyed it when I am pressed to set myself up in apparent opposition to modern science. This is a point on which I am particularly anxious to avoid misunderstanding. I assure you that it costs me a real effort to do anything of the sort, and that I only do it at those precise points where I myself am able to carry further what science has to say. My sense of responsibility is such that it will not permit me to bring forward anything that conflicts with the opinions of modern science unless I am able to cite what science itself has to say on the subject. No one, having such an attitude, could possibly approach the all-important matters which are to occupy us in the next few days, without the deepest sense of awe and the responsibility that goes with it. Unfortunately, it has to be said that as regards the questions we shall have to face, modern science is bound to break down altogether. Modern scientists are not even in a position to know why this should be so, and why their science must necessarily prove so hopelessly amateurish regarding the great and real problems of life and of existence. So, although in a short course of lectures it is obviously not possible to engage in polemics about every detail, please take it for granted that with regard to all I say, I am fully aware of the modern scientific outlook on these subjects. I must confine myself, as far as possible, to what is positive, and trust that in a circle of anthroposophists this will always be understood. Yesterday I endeavored to show you that those tremendous primordial words with which the Bible opens, words which are in a language of quite a different nature from modern tongues, can only be rightly interpreted if we try to forget the attitude of feeling we have acquired in response to the usual modern renderings. For the language in which these all-powerful words of creation were originally given to us does indeed possess the characteristic that the very nature of its sounds directs our hearts and minds towards those pictures which arise before the eye of the seer, EYE, when he contemplates the moment of the welling forth of the sense-perceptible part of our world out of the supersensible element. There is such power, such force in every single sound in which the primordial origin of our earth existence is set before us. In the course of these lectures, we shall often have cause to refer to the character of this language. Today, however, let us confine ourselves to some of the first essentials. You know that in the Bible, after the words I endeavored to sketch for you yesterday, there comes a description of one of the complexes arising out of the creative thinking of the gods. I told you that we have to picture that as if out of cosmic memory two complexes arose. One was a complex which may be compared to the nature of thoughts which can arise in us, the other to our desire or will nature. The one complex contains all that drives toward outer manifestation, tends, as it were, to proclaim its force, Hashamayim. The other complex, Ha'aretz, consists of an inner activity filled with desire. Then we are told of certain qualities of this inwardly active, enlivening element, and these are indicated in the Bible with sounds which portray their character. We are told that this inwardly active element was in a condition described as tohu wabohu, quote, without form and void, close quote. I'll say that again to the best of my ability. Tohu wabohu. And tohu is T-O-H-U. Wabohu is W-A accent B-O-H-U. Tohu wabohu. End of reader's aside. To understand what is meant by tohu wabohu, we must paint a picture of it. And we shall only succeed in this if, out of our spiritual scientific knowledge, we call to mind what it was that, after its passage through the Saturn, Sun, and Moon stages, re-emerged and surged through space as our Earth existence, as our planet Earth. I pointed out yesterday that what we call the solid condition, namely that which offers resistance to our senses, did not exist during the Saturn, Sun, and Moon stages. All that existed then were the elements of fire or warmth, gas or air, and water. Basically, it was not until the planet Earth stage emerged that the solid element was added to the previous elemental conditions, so that when the moment occurred that we described yesterday of the Sun as beginning to split off from the Earth, this was the moment when the elements of warmth, air, and water began mutually to interpenetrate. What we have to imagine as this preliminary surging interpenetration is the meaning of the phrase, quote, without form and void, close quote. Though this is a quite inexact expression, and it is eloquently rendered by the succession of sounds, tohu wabohu. What then does tohu wabohu mean? If we picture what can be stirred to life in us by these sounds, it is something like the following. The sound which resembles our own ti calls up a picture of forces diverging from a central point in every direction of space. Thus, in the moment one utters the ti sound, one has the picture of forces raying out from a central point in every direction into infinite distances. So, we have to imagine the elements of warmth, air, and water permeating and interpenetrating each other, and within them a raying out as from a center in all directions. And this raying out would be there if we only heard the first part of the sound structure, tohu. What does the second part of the phrase signify? It expresses the very opposite of what I have just described. Bet, the sound which resembles our be, has the character of calling forth in our imagination the picture of an enormous sphere, a hollow sphere with yourself inside it, and rays proceeding from every point inside this sphere toward the center. Thus you imagine a point in space with forces streaming out in all directions, and this is tohu. Then these forces are arrested, as it were, by an outer spherical enclosure, and turned back on themselves from every direction of space, and this is bohu. Then, if you imagine this, and think of all the rays of force filled with the three elemental entities of warmth, air, and water, then you know the nature of the complex of inner animated activity. The very sound structure itself shows us how the being of the elements was administered and ruled by the Elohim. How far has this brought us? We shall not understand the whole enormous dramatic process of the 7 days of creation unless we bring these details to mind. If we do so, then the whole thing will present itself to us as a powerful cosmic drama. What are we being told? Let us remember once again that in all that is conveyed by the verb bara, in the beginning the gods created, in quotes, we are connected with a soul spiritual activity. I compared this yesterday to the thought complexes which are called up in our own souls. So we may think of the Elohim reposing in space, and of what is indicated by, in quotes, created, bara, as a cosmic kind of thinking. What the Elohim call up in thought is expressed by Hashamayim and Ha'aretz, an outward raying and an inner activating. Now, however, our attention is drawn to something else of great significance. To have as close a comparison as possible, picture yourselves in the moment of awakening. Groups of ideas arise in your mind. In the Elohim's minds, Hashamayim and Ha'aretz arise. However, we emphasized yesterday that these Elohim came over to Earth evolution at the stage to which they had evolved during the Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolutions. So they were in a similar situation to you when you wake up and bring groups of thoughts to mind. You can contemplate these thoughts in a kind of soul-spiritual way. You can tell what they are like. You can say, quote, "When I wake up in the morning and recall what was previously in my mind, and what I am now calling up, I can describe it." Close quote. It was approximately the same for the Elohim when they said to themselves, quote, "Let us now think creatively about what arises in our souls when we recall all that took place during the old Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolutions. Let us see what it looks like when we remember it." Close quote. What it looked like is described in the words Tohu Wabohu, and could be expressed by the picture I gave you of rays streaming out from a center into space and back again, in such a way that the elements interacted in these rays of force. Thus the Elohim could say roughly, quote, "This is what things look like after we have brought them to this point. This is how they re-emerge." Close quote. So, as to understand what comes next, and what is usually rendered in modern languages in the words, quote, "Darkness was upon the face of the waters," close quote, we must consider something else. We must once more turn our attention to the course of evolutionary events before the Earth stage began. First, we have the Saturn stage working its way into the element of fire. Then the Sun stage is added with its element of air. In my title, Outline of Esoteric Science, you can read up, however, that something else was connected with the arrival of air. The element of gas or air was not the only thing that was added to the element of warmth. That is, so to speak, the coarsening of the warmth element. The finer warmth element of ancient Saturn was coarsened to the element of gas. But each such coarsening is connected with the arising of something of a finer nature. Just as a coarsening to the element of gas is the equivalent of a descending process, there is also an ascent to the element of light. So when we proceed from old Saturn to old Sun, we have to say that Saturn consists solely of the element of weaving warmth, whereas during the Sun stage, something coarser, the gaseous element, is added, but also the element of light, which enables the warmth and the gas to reveal themselves in outward radiance. If we now look at the one group of thoughts, the one expressed by Ha'aretz, usually translated as earth, in quotes, we have to ask how the Elohim, when they had brought it alive in their memory, would have described it. They could not have described it as a revival of what already existed in Old Sun, for the element of light was not there. That had withdrawn. Ha'aretz had therefore become one-sided. It did not bring with it the light, but only the coarser elements, water, air, and warmth. True, the light was not absent in what is expressed by Hashamayim, but Hashamayim is the sun nature which issues from the other complex of thoughts. In this other complex, there was no refinement of the elements. There was no light. So we may say that in one of the complexes, the warmth, air, and water elements were all mixed together in the way indicated by tohu wabohu. These elements were laid bare and lacked the light which had entered evolution with the old sun. They remained dark and had none of the sun nature about them, for that had withdrawn from them with hashamayim. Thus the progression to the earth stage means nothing else than that the light, which the planet still had so long as the sun remained united with it, had now withdrawn, and a dark mass of warmth, air, and water elements had been left behind as ha-aretz. So, now, we have a more detailed picture of the thoughts of the Elohim, but we shall never be able to picture them in the right way unless we are conscious all the time that the elements of air, water, and warmth are in fact also the external expression of spiritual beings. It would not be quite correct to say their garment, for we should think of it more as an outer manifestation. Therefore, all that we call air, water, and warmth are basically maya, illusion. They exist only for outer perception, including the perception of the mind's eye, EYE. In fact, the real nature of these elements is soul spiritual, and they are an outer manifestation of the soul spiritual nature of the Elohim. However, if we want to know what the Elohim look like, we must not think of them as looking as yet at all human. For their actual goal was to give man his form and call him into existence in his own individual organization, which was about to be created by them, in their thoughts. So we must not think of them as human. But we must certainly envisage that there is already in their makeup a kind of split. When we speak of the human being today, we do not understand him at all unless we distinguish between body, soul, and spirit. You know what great efforts we anthroposophists make to get a closer understanding of the activity and nature of this trinity in man, his body, soul, and spirit. To recognize this unity in trinity first becomes necessary in the case of man, and we should be making the greatest mistake to think of beings before man, the beings whom the Bible calls the Elohim, as if they resembled man. Nevertheless, in their case, we must certainly distinguish between a kind of body and a kind of spirit. When you distinguish between body and spirit in man, you are well aware that even his outer form bears testimony to the fact that his being lives in it in a variety of ways. For instance, we do not try to locate man's mind in his hands or legs, but we say that his bodily functions are in his trunk and his limbs, that the organ of his mind is in the head, the brain is the instrument of the mind. This is how we think of the division in the external human form, understanding that some parts are more the expression of the physical body, while other parts are more the expression of the spirit. We have to look upon the Elohim in a similar, even if not quite the same way. All the surging mass I was talking about can only be correctly understood if it is looked upon as the bodily vehicle of the Elohim's soul-spirit nature. Everything presented in the way of the elements of air, warmth, and water are the external embodiment of the Elohim. But we have to make a further distinction. We have to look upon the watery and gaseous elements as more connected with the bodily and coarser functions of the Elohim, and see the warmth element that intermingles with the air and water, this tohu wabohu, as the element in which what we can call the spirit of the Elohim is at work. Just as, where man is concerned, we say that the more bodily part functions in his trunk and the limbs, and the more spiritual part in his head. So if we look upon the entire cosmos as an embodiment of the Elohim, we can say that their more specifically bodily part lived in the air and the water, and their spiritual part moved in the warmth. Thus we now see the cosmos itself as an embodiment of the Elohim. Having characterized their outer embodiment as a tohu wabohu of elemental beings, we have localized the active spirit of the Elohim in the warmth element intermingling with the elemental beings. The Bible uses a remarkable phrase to express the relationship of this spiritual part of the Elohim to the elements. I'm going to give it a try. Ruach Elohim Mrachefet. A remarkable phrase we must go into more closely if we want to understand how the spirit of the Elohim intermingled with the other elements. We can only understand the word Rashef if we enlist the help of everything this word conjured up in the souls of those who heard it. If we simply say, quote, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, close quote, we have not said anything. We can only arrive at a real elucidation of this verb, rashef, if we imagine a hen sitting on her eggs and the warmth of the hen radiating out over the eggs beneath her. Parenthesis, I know this is a crude illustration, but it does help to bring out the meaning. Close quote. If you think of the activity of the brooding warmth streaming from the hen into the eggs to bring them to maturity, then you have an idea of the verb used to describe what the spirit does in the element of warmth. It would, of course, be quite inaccurate to say that the spirit of the Elohim broods, because what we understand today by the physical activity of brooding is not what is meant. It is far rather the activity of the radiating warmth that is being described. Just as warmth radiates from the hen, the spirit of the Elohim radiated by means of the warmth element into the other elements of air and water. When you think of this picture, you have an image of what is meant by the words, quote, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, close quote. Up to a point, we have now reconstructed the picture which hovered in the mind of the ancient Hebrew sage when he thought about this primordial state. We have constructed a complex of warmth, air, and water intermingling in a spherical form, such as I have described tohu wabohu to be, from which all the light had withdrawn with the Hashamayim, and this intermingling of the three elemental conditions was inwardly interwoven with darkness. In one of these elements, the warmth, there works the spirituality of the Elohim, expanding in all directions with the expanding warmth, and bringing to maturity what is still immature in the dark element. So, when we come to the end of the sentence, usually rendered by the words, quote, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, close quote, we have a description of one of the parts conveyed in the opening verse of the Bible by Ha'aretz, namely earth. We have a characterization of what is left behind after Hashamayim has withdrawn. Let us now recall the earlier conditions. We can go back from the earth to the stages of the moon, the sun, and Saturn. Let us go back to the sun. We know that at that time it was out of the question that there could be a separation between what we today call earth from the sun. Therefore it was impossible that the earth could be illuminated by light from outside. That is, of course, an essential aspect of our life on earth, that the light comes to us from outside. If you imagine the earth's sphere as enclosed within the sun, forming part of the sun and not receiving light, but itself forming part of the undivided entity that rayed light out into space, you have a picture of the sun stage. We can sum it up by saying that then the earth element did not receive light, but dispersed it, for it was itself a source of light. Look at the difference. At the old sun stage, the earth itself participated in shedding light, whereas in its new condition, at the earth stage, it no longer does so. The earth has surrendered all the light-giving element and is dependent on receiving light from outside. Light now has to shine into it. That is the essential difference between the earth as it has become in the course of evolution and the sun stage. With the separation of the sun of Hashamayim, the light accompanied it. It is now outside the earth, and the elemental existence which intermingles in Ha'aretz as Tohu Wabohu has no light of its own, but only what we can call, quote, hovered over and warmed through by the spirit of the Elohim, close quote. This, however, did not make it bright in itself, but left it dark. Let us take another look at this elementary existence as a whole. You know, of course, from earlier lectures, that when we enumerate what we call the elemental conditions on earth, we begin with the solid element, and follow that with water, gas, or air, and then warmth. These constitute, as it were, the densest conditions of matter, but these are not all of them. If we ascend further, we meet with finer conditions, but just calling them finer substances does not tell us much about them. The main thing is to recognize them as relatively finer than the denser ones of gas, warmth, and so on. They are usually called etheric conditions, and we have always described light as the first of these. So if we descend from warmth into the next stage below it, in density, we come to gas, and if we ascend, we come to light. Going up a stage beyond light, we come to an even finer etheric condition, to something which is not actually directly there in the ordinary sense world. We are only presented with a kind of external reflection of it. From the occult point of view, one can say that the forces in this finer ether are those which govern the chemical affinities and combinations of material substances, the organization of matter such as we can observe it. Such as we can observe if, for instance, we place a fine powder on a metal plate and then draw a violin bow down the edge of the plate and obtain the so-called Chladni's plate patterns. What the physical sound produces in the powder is happening, of course, in space. However, space is differentiated and is filled with the movement of forces which are more rarefied than light, and which represent at the spiritual level what sound is in the sense world. So when we ascend from warmth to light, and from there to this finer element, we can speak of a chemical or sound ether, which contains the forces to differentiate matter, to separate and combine substances, but in reality is of the nature of sound, of which the sense-perceptible sound heard by the ear is only the outward expression, namely the expression of its passage through the air. This brings us close to this finer element which is above light, so that when we say that the power to manifest outwardly withdrew from the Ha'aretz with the Hashamayim, we must not think only of what manifests as light, but also of the finer etheric element of sound which permeates light. Just as we go downward from warmth to air, and from there to water, we can go upward from warmth to light, and from light to sound, to the element governing chemical substances. And from water we can descend further to the earth element. Where do we arrive if we ascend from the sound ether to an even higher, more rarefied etheric condition, which also withdrew with Hashamayim? We come to the finest etheric state of all, weaving within the sound or chemical ether. If you hearken with your spiritual ear in this direction, you do not hear a sound vibrating in the air, of course. But you hear the sound which disseminates space, permeates it, and organizes substances, just as the tone produced by the violin bow organizes the chladni sound figures. But into this condition, brought about by the sound ether, there streams an even higher etheric state. This even finer ether permeates the sound ether, just as the sound our mouth utters is permeated with the meaning of our thought, turning the sound into word. Try to comprehend what it is that makes a sound into a meaningful word, and then you will have a picture of this finer etheric element moving cosmically through the organizing universal sound, giving it meaning as it reverberates in space as the creative word. This word streaming through space, pouring itself into the sound ether, is the source of life, is vigorous, vibrant life. Thus what withdrew out of Haaretz with Hashomayim, what went with the sun as distinct from the lower part, the earth, that is the Tohu Wabohu, is something which can manifest outwardly as light. But behind the light is spiritual sound, and behind even that is cosmic speech. Therefore we may say that the brooding warmth is the first form of expression of the lower spiritual part of the Elohim, somewhat as our own life of desire spends itself in the lower part of our soul. The higher spirituality of the Elohim, which went out with the Hashomayim, lives in the light, in spiritual sound, in the spiritual word, the cosmic word. These higher qualities can only stream back into the Tohu Wabohu again from outside. Let us now try to get a picture of the whole of what hovered before the soul of the ancient Hebrew sage as the Haaretz and the Hashomayim. When the forces of spiritual light, of sound, of the forming of the sounds of speech and the creating of words shines onto the earth again, how does it come across? It has the effect of articulate light coming from the sun, as light giving utterance to cosmic speech. So, let us think of all the darkness we are presented with in Tohu Wabohu, with its intermingling warmth, air, and water. Let us think of it in its light-forsaken darkness. And then let us think that out of the activity of the Elohim, through the creative word, which as the highest ether entity lies behind their activity, there rays in with the light all that streams forth from the word. How is one to describe what is taking place? The most appropriate way to describe it is to say that the beings who, with Hashomayim, have withdrawn their highest qualities up into the etheric realm, radiated answering light from out of cosmic space into the Tohu Wabohu. These are the real facts behind the monumental words, "And God said, let there be light, and there was light in the darkness, that was Tohu Wabohu." Here you have the picture which hovered before the soul of the ancient Hebrew sage. So we must think of the beings of the Elohim as spread out over the whole cosmos, thinking of this whole cosmos as their body, and the elemental existence in the Tohu Wabohu as the lowest form of this body, of the warmth as a somewhat higher form, and the Hashomayim which withdrew and now works creatively into the whole formation of the Tohu Wabohu as the form taken by their highest spiritual part. You now see what I am leading up to, that it was the light-bringing cosmic word which brought order into the tohu wabohu, the surging elements, and made it what it later became. Where was the point from which the organizing of the human form took place? There can be no human form such as we have, standing upright on our two legs, making use of our hands the way we do, unless it is organized by forces emanating from the brain. Our human form is organized by the highest spiritual forces streaming forth from our own spirit. What is lower is always organized by what is higher. Thus in the Ha'aretz, as the body of the Elohim, as it were, the lower part was organized by the higher bodily part, the Hashamayim, and the spiritual essence of the Elohim working within it. So, the highest spirituality of the Elohim takes possession of what has been left to itself and organizes it, as expressed by the words, quote, "The light manifesting in the cosmic word streams into the darkness." Close quote. This is how the tohu wabohu was organized, raised up from out of the disorder of the elements. So, if you think of the Hashamayim as a kind of head of the Elohim, and the elements left behind as the trunk and limbs, and these elements, the trunk and limbs, being organized through the power of the head, then you have the actual process. Then you have the human being enlarged, as it were, to fill the whole cosmos. And in this cosmos he organizes himself out of the spiritual organs contained in Hashamayim. When we think of all the streams of energy which pour down from the Hashamayim to the Ha'aretz, we may venture to picture a macrocosmic human being working on his own organization. So as to paint the picture even more exactly, let us now turn our attention to the human being as he is today. Let us ask ourselves how the human being has become as he is. I mean, as he is to the spiritual scientist, not to ordinary science. What is it that has given him the special configuration which distinguishes him from all the other living creatures around him? What is it that actually makes him human? What force is working throughout this human form? Unless you deliberately close your eyes to it, it is very easy to pinpoint what makes him man. It is something he possesses and none of the other creatures around him in earthly existence possess. Speech, the sounds of speech. This is what makes us human. Think of the animal form and ask yourselves how it could be raised to the level of the human form. What would have to enter in for it to become human? Let us put the question this way. Let us think of an animal form and imagine we had to pour something into it, breathe something into it. What would this breath have to contain to make this form begin to speak? It would have to feel changed to the point where it brought forth the sounds of speech. It is the sounds of speech which make the animal form into a human form. So, how can we imagine the picture of the cosmos? Create an inner feeling of what it is like. How can we build up a feeling of all the pictures I have presented to you, of all the intricate pictures I have described to you, of the life of the elements? How can we create a feeling of all this? Create an inner feeling for the structure of the macrocosmic human being. By beginning to feel how the sounds of speech come to life within it. When the sound ah sounds forth through the air, learn to feel not only its tone, but the form it makes. Just as the tone of the violin bow drawn down the edge of a metal plate makes a form in the dust. Learn to feel the ah and the b in their movement through space. Experience them not merely as sound, but as form-making. Then you will feel what the Hebrew sage felt when the sounds of speech stimulated him to see the pictures I have put before your mind's eye. This was the effect the sounds of speech had. This was why I had to tell you that bet, b, aroused the idea of an enclosing gesture, like a shell shutting something off and enclosing it within. Resh, r, stimulated a feeling such as one has when one feels one's head, and shin suggested what I call pricking or poking. This is a thoroughly objective language, a language which, if the soul is receptive, crystallizes into pictures as the sounds are uttered. In the sounds themselves lies the lofty schooling which led the sages to the pictures which crowd in upon the soul of the seer when he enters the supersensible world. The sounds of speech are transmuted into spiritual form and conjure up pictures which come together as a connected whole in the way I have described. What is so significant about this ancient record is that it has been preserved in a language, the sounds of which are form-creating, which crystallize in the soul into forms. And these forms are the very pictures which one gets when one penetrates into the supersensible realm out of which the material part of our physical earth planet has evolved. When you realize this, you will be filled with a feeling of deep awe and reverence for the way the world has evolved. It will dawn on you that it is truly by no mere chance that this tremendous document of human existence has been transmitted in this script, a script which by means of its very characters is capable of awakening spiritual images in the soul and guiding us to what in our time the seer is to discover anew. This is the feeling the anthroposophist should cultivate on approaching this ancient record with which the Old Testament begins. The end of Lecture 2.